You're listening to Civic from the San Francisco Public Press. On this edition, we'll talk about a new report seeking to identify the roots of structural racism and finding that a lot of racial inequity can be traced back to residential segregation.
A lot of people assume, okay, you have systemic racism. Surely there's a racist individual somewhere behind that system or that started it all. Well, not necessarily, actually. A lot of these systems can produce disparities even without a racist actor either behind it today or even historically. And so structural racism is an attempt to reframe the cause of racial inequality from something that's consciously created and maintained to something that can operate without conscious intentionality.
I'm Laura Wenis, and this is Civic. Racial segregation has widespread effects. Research has shown links to infant mortality, asthma, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, hypertension, obesity, and other negative health outcomes. Where you lived growing up is also linked with your likely income as an adult. Black children raised in integrated neighborhoods earn nearly $1,000 more a year as adults and $4,000 more when raised in white neighborhoods than those raised in highly segregated communities of color. A similar pattern has been found for Latino children. Those raised in integrated neighborhoods earned $844 more a year as adults and $5,000 a year more when raised in white neighborhoods than those raised in highly segregated communities of color. Generally, household incomes and home values in white neighborhoods are nearly twice as high as those in segregated communities of color. These are some of the key points laid out in a new report from UC Berkeley's Othering and Belonging Institute, called the Roots of Structural Racism Project. And with all these outcomes in mind, here's the thing about that segregation. In many places across the country, it's been getting worse. Looking at every U.S. metropolitan region with more than 200,000 residents, the report found that 81% were more segregated as of 2019 than they were in 1990. If you want to look at a particular region or city, the report comes with an interactive map where you can adjust sliders to see how segregation has changed over time. The most segregated regions are the Midwest and Mid-Atlantic, followed by the West Coast. The Bay Area got more racially diverse, but also more racially segregated. The report notes about this region specifically that life expectancy is more than 5 years longer in white neighborhoods than in highly segregated Black and Latino neighborhoods. Here's the big takeaway. Quote, by virtually any measure of well-being, from employment, income, educational attainment, access to healthcare, and a healthy environment, residential segregation based upon group identity is a driver of unequal outcomes. End quote. I talked with one of the report's authors, Stephen Menendian, assistant director and director of research at the Othering and Belonging Institute at UC Berkeley. You've said that if we don't deal with the root causes of racism, we won't be able to address, you know, some of the symptoms, segregation, for instance. This report points out that there's a sort of ambivalence and a lack of appreciation for the role that racial residential segregation plays in having formed and now sustaining racial disparities and injustices. And that's across things like health, education, public safety, employment, generational wealth. When we talk about the roots of structural racism, as in the title of this project and report, it sounds like you're saying the root is residential segregation. Can you illustrate that or flesh that out just a bit to get us started?
Yes, I love this question. So in the last year and a half, there's been what the media has dubbed a racial reckoning. And a reckoning is an interesting term because it suggests that there is an awareness, a shift or changed awareness, right? And reckoning also comes with accountability. Accountability implies policy change, it implies legal change, it implies cultural change. And what's changed is that more Americans in surveys are aware of racial inequality than have ever been aware of it before in the last two generations. That is to say that more white people, in particular, recognize that the playing field is not level across racial gradients. Right. So, for example, in Pew surveys last year, more white people than basically in two generations said that African Americans and other racialized minorities do not have equal opportunity in the United States, that there is something structural or systemic. Right. So if that's true, if people have greater awareness of it, then we have to actually specify what that it is. It's not enough just to say that there are inequalities, that there are disparities, because in almost any realm of life, you can identify disparities, right? We recognize that there are disparities in police brutality, that there are disparities in life expectancy, there are disparities in COVID infection, hospitalization, and death rates. The question is, what's driving those disparities? Is it, as some people posit, just racist individuals, like a racist police officer like Derek Chauvin, or perhaps a culture of racism in police departments? Or is it something beneath that? Is it something that's actually separating people from resources and life-enhancing environments by race? And I believe it's the latter, not the former. And that's where a lot of people get tripped up. Because when we use the term racism, most Americans still think of racism in individualistic terms, meaning that you have a racist actor who is, you know, full of prejudice and bias and animus, right? And they enact their racism against a person who is racially marginalized or historically disadvantaged. But when we talk about systemic and structural racism, we're talking about something very different. We're talking about the arrangement of institutions and markets in ways that produce inequality, even in the absence of a racist actor. Now, a lot of people, this is the most critical nuance, and a lot of people lose this subtlety. A lot of people assume, okay, you have systemic racism. Surely there's a racist individual somewhere behind that system that put it into play or into operation, or that started it all. Well, not necessarily, actually. A lot of these systems can produce disparities even without a racist actor either behind it today or even historically. That's where people get really confused. And so structural racism is an attempt to reframe the cause of racial inequality from something that's consciously created and maintained to something that can operate without conscious intentionality. And that is what really people get tripped up on. And what we are trying to say here in this report is that all these other forms of racial disparities are epiphenomenon. They're the symptoms. Whereas racial residential segregation is really the core cause. It's the core cause because what it does is it sorts people into three geographies. It sorts them into neighborhoods, it sorts them into municipalities, and it sorts them into regions. And it sorts them into different places within those geographies that are either high opportunity or low opportunity based on race. So if you are born Black in the United States, it's far, far more likely, even if you're middle income or affluent, if your family is high income or middle income, to be born into a low opportunity environment than if you are born poor and white in the United States. That's really what we mean, or what I mean, by structural racism. And I think there's just a lot of nuances there that get overlooked. Yes, racial residential segregation is the core force there because where you live determines access to jobs, access to the school that your children are assigned to, whether you live in a healthy environment that has low particulate matter, exhaust fumes, waste treatment or transfer facilities, safe drinking water or leaded water, all these things, access to transit, amenities like grocery stores that have fresh produce, a safe neighborhood, right? Do you have crime in your neighborhood or not? All of those are determined by where you live. So where you live is at the very heart of structured racial inequality in the United States. Now, one quick note. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people who are more conservative in, ideologically or in their orientation, who will say that racial disparities are not caused by anything structural. They'll say it's caused by just differences in group behaviors, habits, proclivities, interests, or even, as Charles Murray would argue, differences in aggregate group intelligence. I would say that it's ridiculous. But what I would say is that even if not every disparity in its particularity is caused by structured systems, institutional arrangements, I would argue that there is sufficient evidence, in fact, a voluminous amount of evidence that most, if not many, are. So when you look at a disparity, whatever the disparity is, it could be high school graduation rates, which have closed as a disparity in 50 years, or college graduation rates, or rates in healthcare coverage, whatever the disparity is, test scores, you can't, whenever you're looking at a disparity, you can't automatically assume that there is a structural force behind it. But I think there is a default presumption that there is. And you have to rebut that default presumption you know, before you can say there's an alternative explanation. And that because there's just so much evidence that these disparities are caused by where people live and how they're situated in society. So that's what we mean by structural racism, is that where people are located, where they're situated more broadly, determines so much of their life chances.
Is it then relevant to ask, you know, who put these structures in place in order to get to a place of how do we dismantle them? Because I hear what you're saying about how people, yeah, you know, think, you know, this is due to one actor, right? And I think part of the inclination toward that is because people want to say, well, it's not me. I am, yes, not perpetuating this. And if it's the structure, I mean, on one hand, when people hear structural racism, I think some people hear, oh God, it's everyone, therefore I'm to blame. And on the other hand, other people say, well, it's the system, not me, so I don't have to worry about it.
Again, I love this question. And I probably went on too long answering the first question, but let me try and do this a little bit more succinctly.
Okay.
I think the question is a very important one. And I think the answer is that we should not be looking for the racist actor behind these systems. Now that sounds like a shocking, shocking explanation, but let me unpack why.
But why don't we need someone to blame?
Exactly. Well, think about something like the environment for a moment, right? When cities or states take action, they have to undertake what's called an environmental impact assessment, right? Like you can't demolish a building or put up a new development or build a park or build whatever, a stadium, without doing an environmental impact assessment. Mm-hmm. What the laws are requiring with environmental impact assessment is not that you can't do anything that harms the environment. Rather, it's making local policymakers confront the impacts of the decisions they have. Right? It's saying, we want you to take cognizance and not ignore the impacts that you have. So in environmental law, you just do the assessment and then you weigh the costs and benefits, right? The same thing needs to be true of race in the United States because, and this is an analogy I've used before, much of structural racism that exists in the United States is really not a byproduct of animus or prejudice. It's actually a byproduct of self-interest. So why is it that white people in the United States disproportionately enjoy high opportunity environments? They live in cities with the highest property values, the strongest tax base, the best health outcomes, the highest concentration of college graduates, the best schools, so on and so forth. Is it just because white people are racist? I actually don't think that's the answer. I think the reason is because they are making decisions in a structure, in a set of systems that benefit them, without actually thinking about, you know, when I move from the city to the suburb, or I move from this one suburb to another, what is the overall impact that my decision has on not my children, but other people's children? We just don't think that way, right? People move for jobs. They move because they want to put their kids in the best school system. They move to where the neighborhoods have the strongest characteristics. The problem is that those decisions have byproducts. Just like when you get into a car and you drive somewhere, your goal is to get somewhere, but you have a byproduct, and that byproduct is releasing CO2 emission, right? Your goal when you drive to the dentist or whatever, isn't to increase the overall amount of CO2 emissions. It's to accomplish a task or an objective. Structural racism is very much like that. When you have a context of dramatic racial wealth disparities in the United States, of dramatic disparities in educational attainment, barriers around municipalities in terms of tax-based sharing and student assignment, it's incredibly simple for people to make self-interested decisions that at an aggregate level have harmful effects. And that's the problem, is that over the last 50 years, we've made it easier and easier for white people in particular to make decisions that are not racist, but have racist effects. Mm. And so the reason I think it's a mistake to ask the question, is there a racist person behind it, is twofold. Number one is because these systems can exist. They're like perpetual motion machines. You know, it's like you dip the little beak on the bird into the water and it just keeps going, right? Hmm. You don't need, whether the person who tips the beak into the water in the first place is racist is actually beside the point, because the system just perpetually recreates itself. But the second reason it's a mistake is because if we are actually going to solve structural racism, we have to be focused on the problem of structural racism. Asking the question, is there, where's the racist behind the web? Like, who created the web, actually slips you back into an individualistic frame. Hmm. So let me give you an example of this. This is a very famous example, but you might remember in the wake of Katrina, there was a telethon where the Red Cross was raising money for the victims of Katrina, the hurricane, and the flooding that ensued. And Mike Myers, the comedian Mike Myers, and the musician, entertainer Kanye West were leading a session of the telethon. And during the middle of the session, Kanye just stopped and said, George Bush doesn't care about Black people, right? Well, let's assume that George Bush was racist and that the inadequate federal response was caused because of his racism. Would that have actually prevented this tragedy from happening? Why was it that African Americans were disproportionately residing in the lower Ninth Ward, where they were disproportionately exposed to the danger of flooding from a major hurricane? Or they disproportionately lacked access to an automobile, which the evacuation plan relied upon, right? It wouldn't have actually changed, even if it theoretically could have changed the response, it wouldn't have changed the tragedy overall. And it's actually a mistake, because the problem wasn't George Bush. The problem was these decades of structural arrangements the United States had built up that exposed African Americans in New Orleans to this tragedy to begin with. So I think actually asking the question, you know, is there racist behind there, and looking for it, is a mistake, because it draws attention away from the web and searches for the spider, when really what we need to be focused on is the web. How is the web constructed? What are the particular interlocking arrangements that produce these disparities? And then how can we begin to deconstruct the web?
I'm speaking with Stephen Menendian, Assistant Director and Director of Research at the Othering and Belonging Institute at UC Berkeley. The Bay Area is very racially diverse and has grown more racially diverse over time, but it has also gotten more racially segregated. How has it done that, both of those things at the same time?
Well, let me just preface the answer by saying I'm not 100% sure. You know, we look at the data and we see that segregation has increased, not just since 1990, but in the Bay Area study we did since 1970. We look at the data and we can see that the Bay Area is much more racially diverse than it was 50 years ago. That's true. The causes are actually something that we decided we're not going to totally canvas and try and completely understand here. Mm-hmm. But I think there's basically two dynamics that help us understand that paradox. The first is that if you disaggregate the forms of segregation, so if you use the dissimilarity index to look at segregation between two individual groups, this, by the way, you can do this around the country, we see that white Asian and white Latino segregation has increased in that period. And white Latino
dissimilarity is a way of saying segregation?
Yeah, dissimilarity is the most commonly used measure of segregation, but it's a binary measure. It looks at two groups at a time: white, black, white Asian, black Latino, etc.
Yeah.
If you look at the dissimilarity index for white Asian and white Hispanic, non-white, both of those have increased in the last 50 years, particularly white Hispanic segregation since 1970 has increased pretty dramatically in the Bay Area. So I think, and I looked around the country, I looked at places like Miami and a number of other cities, and white Hispanic segregation has been increasing in the last 30 to 40 to 50 years. So I think that has contributed to it. The overall aggregate level of segregation hasn't been increasing because whites are more segregated from Latinos than they were 30, 40, 50 years ago. I think, though, that's only a small part of the story. I think the larger part of the story is that our regions have diversified, but the neighborhoods that have diversified are typically non-white. So Asians have have grown tremendously in the Bay Area. Like, it's several hundred percent, depending on where you start the count. But they've moved into neighborhoods that were maybe once, you know, predominantly white, but are now pretty diverse, while white people have moved into more, you know, heavily white neighborhoods. Or Hispanics have moved, and this is particularly the case, into historically black neighborhoods. So like East Palo Alto, you know, a generation ago was very heavily black. Now it's 60-some percent Hispanic. Richmond, same thing. North Richmond is the exact same pattern. So I think what's happened is that our neighborhoods are diversified, except these heavily white and heavily affluent enclaves around the Bay Area, like Lafayette, like Walnut Creek, like Los Altos. You know, there's just a number of them that have just maintained their whiteness, even as most of the Bay has increasingly diversified. And that becomes starker and starker because as the relative percentage of white in the population in the Bay Area goes down, you know, in Alameda and Contra Costa County, whites are 40% of the population.
Yep.
But you have suburbs where whites are 70, 80% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I think that is actually the main cause of why segregation remains so high, is that mm-hmm. whites, there's a large portion of whites, not on necessarily on average, but a large portion of white people in the Bay Area that live in heavily white neighborhoods and communities.
You point out that there's never been a Brown v. Board of Education for housing. And putting aside for a moment that schools have actually also, I think in many cases, gradually resegregated, there's no authority that's going to be able to compel people to live in certain neighborhoods. And, you know, even if there had been, it would be very difficult to implement. You can bus kids into schools to integrate them.
Right.
But our attempt to outlaw racial segregation in neighborhoods, the Fair Housing Act, really didn't achieve that at all. After its passage in 1968, residential integration actually, I think, increased and then decreased over time.
Yes.
Can you talk about the progression of what happened there?
Well, I can tell you did a close reading of this report, and I appreciate that. So you're absolutely right that we had a national initiative to desegregate schools. And I think people lose sight of the fact how successful it actually was. You know, in the Jim Crow South in mid-1960s, very few African Americans actually attended integrated schools. By the late 1980s and early 1990s, actually a strong majority of Black students attended what were called desegregated schools. The problem and the outcomes, by the way, you can find research on this from Rucker Johnson. Hannah Nicole Jones did a phenomenal piece on this for NPR. The research shows that those students had much better life outcomes across almost any measure that matters. The problem is that project of desegregation was relatively short-lived. It mostly happened between 1972 and 1988. You could say, 1968 when the courts got really serious in the early 1990s if you want to broaden it a bit. The problem, as you point out, is that we never had such a project for housing. David Brooks wrote a very interesting op-ed a couple of years ago, which is linked in our reports, that said, we actually did the wrong thing. We should have integrated neighborhoods, not schools. Because if we'd integrated neighborhoods, schools would have followed. And it's understandable that once courts got out of the business of monitoring desegregation, which they by and large have, that schools would just revert back to the neighborhood patterns, right? The neighborhood demographics. And so what's happened is that schools have resegregated because of that. Now, the goal isn't necessarily to create perfect integration by neighborhoods. The goal should be to open up neighborhoods to give people more choice. If you survey Black Americans and white Americans and you ask them, what's their ideal neighborhood? Almost invariably, their ideal neighborhood is much more integrated than the neighborhoods they currently live in. Yeah. So then the question is, why do people not live in the neighborhoods that are closer to their ideal? Well, it's because of the structural forces that I described at the beginning of the show, right? That mm-hmm. people are navigated, they're steered in by structural forces into these different neighborhoods. And if we actually opened up more opportunity and more housing options for people, then we would have, people would exercise those options. Not everyone would, but we would be much more integrated than we are today. The problem is that we don't exercise those options. And every time we give people those options, there's tremendous pushback. There's enormous NIMBYism around the country to providing, for example, affordable housing opportunities that would create more options for people of color in heavily white neighborhoods. You can watch the television show, Show Me a Hero, about school desegregation. All the venom, all the intensity, all the opposition to that is even greater when it comes to housing than it was for mm-hmm. schools. And often, there was in the Hannah Nicole Jones interview, which I actually re-listened to this weekend, they were talking about an inadvertent desegregation plan in Missouri, where the school district that Michael Brown had attended became unaccredited, lost its accreditation. And a statewide law required that the students who attended that school should have the option to go to another surrounding school system. And the white school system that had to take transfers from Michael Brown's district, the parents were, and this was in 2012-13, they were up in arms, absolutely opposed it. They said, I am not a racist. This is about the quality of education that I bought this home, blah, blah, blah. that you get that on a tenfold scale if you open up neighborhoods. That was in the Obama administration, you know, era. That not 1980s. The Show Me a Hero was set, let alone the 1960s or let alone the 1970s, where in South Boston, people in South Boston, white people rioted against desegregation. So you have to overcome that resistance. That, and it's generally white resistance. But again, it's, to me, some of it may be racist. You know, I don't want my kids attending schools with black children. But I think by and large, it's incredibly selfish. Just, I do not want to share my resources, my public goods, in any way that could theoretically dilute the quality of it for my children by letting low-income children or children of color or any other children into it, whether it's my neighborhood, whether it's my school system, you know, or whatever.
So according to the project landing page, this came out of a multi-part report series on segregation focused on the San Francisco Bay Area that the Othering and Belonging Institute published from 2018 to 2020, which informed efforts by the Berkeley City Council in February 2021 to reconsider exclusionary zoning, which you've brought up. Have you seen leaders in other cities that have been found to be very segregated, like, say, San Francisco, have you seen them take action in response to these findings?
So there have been a number of cities that are actually taking action here. Minneapolis was the first to really look at zoning reform. I think that we are going to see more and more. There was Oakland has brought it up as a potential issue. They were looking at it. There are a number of smaller municipalities around the country, in Connecticut in particular, they're looking at this. There was one other I was looking for, but there are a number of other cities that are beginning to look at this. It's going to take a little while, I think, because first they have to study the issue and then they put it into a planning process. It basically takes about 2 years from start to finish. But I think there are. I really do. I think it's not just whether cities are taking it up. I think city leaders are beginning to take this up and then will begin reconsidering this on a growing scale. Along with Berkeley.
Is there anything you wanted to say that I didn't give you a chance to?
No, that was great.
That was Stephen Menendian, Assistant Director and Director of Research at the Othering and Belonging Institute at UC Berkeley. You can find the full report at belonging.berkeley.edu. I'm Laura Wenis, and you've been listening to Civic. Before I let you go today, at the Public Press, which is Civic's parent organization, we've been working really hard during this pandemic to pursue angles we're not seeing much coverage of elsewhere, or to take a more systemic look at the issues that are surfacing in the headlines. The San Francisco Public Press is a nonprofit, and we're inspired by the public radio model. That's the idea that people who are able to support the work that we do so everyone can have access to it without paywalls or ads. If you think we're onto something, we'd very much appreciate if you could show your support. You can do that by going to sfpublicpress.org/donate or by helping us get the word out about this show. Subscribe on whichever podcast platform you use or leave us a review. It really does help. So thank you.